You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, October 13th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Zach Roth, MSNBC digital reporter, author of The Great Suppression, Voting Rights, Corporate Cash, and the Conservative Assault on Democracy. Also on the program, Trump will sue. I will sue you. I'll sue you for all the reports literally coming in as we speak of women who over the past 30 some odd years have been groped, molested, assaulted by Donald Trump. Also, more WikiLeaks, leaks. DNC had their thumb on the scales, and she's a centrist. But also, she also wants single-payer health care. And the Republican Civil War moves into the rescindments of endorsements era. Not to be confused with the upcoming rescindment of the endorsements era. We still got three and a half weeks to go on this. We could have multiple rescindments. Rescindments. You get a cookie if you know where that lands you. Down ballot now in play. Meanwhile, U.S. naval bombing in Yemen, or I should say, U.S. Navy bombs Yemen. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau attacked by a three-person panel of the D.C. Circuit Court. And they actually may have, their ruling may have backfired. Lastly, Chelsea Manning finally released from solitary for the crime of attempting suicide. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. House cleaning is the proper word, but folks, I've mentioned this before. The guys from the and gals from the Screaming Majority, who years ago used to do a weekly song for this program, they have a rock. Oh, well, I guess it's a musical. I was going to say a rock opera, but I don't. I think it's just a musical, and it is. You can check it out at Waste, Fraud, and Abuse, the musical. .com. It's down in New York City. And I can, off the top of my head, I can't remember where it is, but it is taking place at 8 o'clock p.m. tonight, tomorrow night, the 15th, and then next weekend, the 20th, 21st, and 22nd. And maybe we'll have one of those guys on tomorrow for a quick hit, just to tell us about it a little bit. We do also have a song of theirs that we'll play. Maybe we'll play it when we go into the break, and then we're going to have to play a second song because it's not that long. But their song, I think, is The End of Satire, which is expresses sort of the era we're in at this point. Also, a question for you, our listeners. Look, I don't do ads unless I feel confident about the product. And that means usually I use the product or I've read about the product. We've turned down enough ads so that our ad broker is, you know, sort of consistently annoyed with us. And I want to just, there's certain situations where I just don't know. And so this may be a little bit odd, but if people have had an experience with Children's International, the charity, it gets a pretty good rating in the charity, on those charity navigators, that type of thing. But, you know, before I sign on to doing some ads for them, I'm obviously doing some other research, but I just wanted to put it out there if people have had good or bad experiences with it. Just because I don't want to promote something that I later regret promoting, like, for instance, FanDuel. I mean, I'm not going to name any names. I don't want to. I wasn't going to say it. But then I did. I didn't. But I don't. But I'm not going to say it again, as it were. All right. And just a heads up, this is what's going to happen over the next week. A lot of insanity would be my guess. Tomorrow's Friday. We'll be here. I will be here on Monday. We'll do a Michael Monday on Tuesday next week. Wednesday night, we will cover the debate live via our YouTube stream and our audio stream. The gang, as I've now just dubbed them, will be here in studio. I will be in the radio row at the debate in Las Vegas. And hopefully we'll have a video feed from there through the studio and pristine audio into the studio. I paid for a 5 meg wired drop, so it better be good. So I shelled out cash for it. But and then hopefully, I think Cliff Schechter is going to be in Vegas at that time, and I'll have some other people. I'll be sitting down with a bunch of other people. It's going to be it's going to be sick, the amount of content I come back with from Vegas, because and then Thursday and Friday, I'm at the Mass Torts Conference. So it'll be a little bit more political than usual, because I'll have gotten stuff. Hopefully, I'll catch up with a lot of different people in Vegas who were there for the debate. But that's basically it. So prepare yourselves, folks, for some really fantastic shows. And then when we return, I don't know. One of the other libertarian presidential candidates reached out to the program following the Daryl Perry interview, and I think he felt that he wanted to take a crack at it. At debating. We haven't responded yet because all the Michigan's going around here, but we're going to reach out and hopefully we'll have him on in the coming weeks too. So all that and more. And so we're going to take a quick break, and we will start with a song by the Screaming Majority from the Waste, Fraud, and Abuse, the musical.com. Waste, Fraud, and Abuse, the musical.com, running this weekend and next in New York City. And then when we come back, we'll be talking to Zach Roth, author of The Great Suppression, Voting Rights, Corporate Cash, and the Conservative Assault on Democracy.
Satire is dead. Satire is dead. Donald Trump killed it. Was right-wing wish fulfilled. We can't laugh anymore. Cause no one's ever been stupid. No one's ever been a bigot. Cause George W. Bush and Ronald Reagan never even existed. Slate's been wiped clean. Satire is dead. Satire is dead.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Zach Roth. He is a MSNBC digital reporter and author of The Great Suppression, Voting Rights, Corporate Cash, and the Conservative Assault on Democracy. Zach, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here. All right, so let's this is it's interesting because on some level, I mean, I think there's an argument to be made, and that we're not necessarily seeing voter suppression in the sense that it wasn't it wasn't necessarily conceived that way of, or at least by many of our founding fathers, right? It was just like, this is how much voting there should be. And maybe it shouldn't be that much.
Yeah. I think the way the founding fathers thought about it was that it made sense to kind of limit who ended up voting and more broadly who ended up participating in our democracy in order to kind of keep some power in the hands of elites. And so they were balancing the sort of Jeffersonian, and Jefferson was a big advocate of kind of extending power to ordinary people. They're balancing those ideas with ideas put forward by Hamilton and by Madison and others, that it was important to keep a lot of power in the hands of the elites because ordinary people weren't really qualified to make these decisions. And there was a fear that they would kind of upend the economic system if they had the power to do that. In Hamilton's big speech at the Constitutional Convention, he talked about needing to limit the I think he put it, the folly of democracy for that reason. So that idea has been with us for a long time, and it's kind of waxed and waned at different points throughout history. But one of the things I argue in the book is that it's back with us again today, and that idea kind of undergirds a lot of what we're seeing in terms of the assault on voting that we've seen recently.
I got to tell you that, like, I have struggled since seeing that quote in your book. I knew the broad outlines of where Hamilton was on this, but my daughter is obsessed with yeah. with Hamilton and is singing it constantly. And I've been like trying to figure out. I just like the fact that she's singing all the time, but I don't want to crush her sense of like inspiration. Like, you know, he's sort of he wasn't terribly generous with giving everybody some power. But all right, so walk us through this, like. Give us, you know, before we get up to this more modern era, walk us through the at least the attack on democracy in this sense, because you outline a couple other fronts on against democracy. But give us a sense of that waxing and waning in terms of who should vote and why?
Sure. What's interesting about it is through history, we've gone through periods of expansion, kind of expansion of democracy and expansion of participation that have been followed by these backlashes. So in the early part of the 19th century, you saw a great expansion by states of they kind of loosened suffrage rules. They drew up district lines in a way that better reflected voters' preferences. They, in various ways, encouraged more people to participate in democracy. And that's, there seemed to be kind of a consensus around that. And that consensus was upended when you had, and this is what's so interesting kind of in relation to today, when you had a wave of immigration or several waves of immigration, first Irish people coming starting in the 1830s, and you began to see voter registration laws, for instance. So New York State put in a voter registration law that applied only in New York City, which was where the Irish were congregating. So a clear effort to kind of make it more difficult for these new immigrants to vote. And then you saw around the period of the Civil War and afterwards, not just the restrictions on black voting in southern states, which we know about, but also in northern states in response to more immigration from Italy and from Eastern Europe, you saw language tests and literacy tests and religious tests, really an effort by the sort of ruling Protestant elite to make it more difficult for these new immigrants, many of whom were Catholics and Jews, to vote. And that period lasted for most of the second half of the 19th century into the 20th century. Then, of course, with the passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, we thought we had kind of overcome that once and for all and opened voting to everybody. And that made voting easier, by the way, again, not only for blacks in the South, though that was obviously the most urgent reason for it, but for language minorities and racial minorities elsewhere. And now, again, in the midst of these demographic changes where we've seen, you know, many states soaring Hispanic population and more broadly the demographic profile of the country changing, we're seeing that directly, in my view, leading to these new efforts to restrict voting, many of which go after racial minorities and new immigrants quite directly.
I mean, I'm struck by two things. One is this dynamic that we saw with the expansion of voting rights, and then the sort of the pushback. And maybe this is sort of obvious that this would exist in all. But you know, we spoke to, I think it was Carol Anderson, the author of White Rage, which outlines how the expansion of African American rights, in particular, was always followed by a pushback that would then begin to undercut those rights. And it's interesting just to see that this dynamic took place in the context of voting, which many times often intersected with the rights of African Americans. But obviously, we're talking about immigrants too in those other eras.
That's right. I mean, there's so many kind of ways to illustrate this. For the first few decades after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, what you saw was Southern states and localities come up with all sorts of schemes, often to do with the way that they would redistrict, the way that they would draw district lines, that were very clearly designed to reduce black voting power. And eventually, the Voting Rights Act came to be enforced, not until the 80s and sometimes the early 90s, the Voting Rights Act came to be enforced in a way that outlawed those things too, but it took a long time. Today, it's no coincidence that, leaving aside sort of the issue of the president's race, it's certainly no coincidence that after he was able to mobilize a coalition of supporters that was largely backed by racial minorities, by the poor, by the young, that you saw this kind of explosion of not only restrictive voting laws themselves, but a kind of broader kind of ideological fear about voting and about allowing voting to be open to more and more people. So you see sometimes in these the rhetoric of Republicans and conservatives, sometimes the veil slips a little bit and they forget to talk about voter fraud. And instead they make comments like, the real danger is uninformed people voting or people who aren't educated voting. I write about in the book Ted Yoho, who's now a congressman from Florida, when he was running in 2012, saying the real danger is having people have the right to vote and not knowing how to use it. That's as dangerous as having a loaded gun and not knowing how to use it. He said it used to be the property owners were the only ones who were allowed to vote. So there's a real kind of underlying fear of ordinary people that has come out in the Obama era when he's been able to mobilize kind of previously marginalized voters.
Right. We see this playing over and over again in history. And just going back though to one point where the voting suppression, let's call it, or I guess maybe, sort of trying to contract the pool of eligible voters because right. They're not worthy. I mean, at one point it seems to me, it does intersect with like aspects of, what was known as the progressive movement in the, late 19th century, early 20th century, where you would see like, reactions to machine politics in places like Chicago and New York, and the introduction of like city manager and town council politics as opposed to like directly electing a mayor. Right, it's trying to diminish the power of people voting. Right, I mean, was it like there's some concept of the way that you're voting is wrong. Like you're not voting on the right principles.
That's right. And if you look at Mitt Romney's famous 47% comments, that's kind of the point he was making. The damage to him came from him kind of saying 47% of the country are these lazy moochers. But his if you look closely, his real point was these people are approaching voting wrong, as you say. They're not voting with the kind of broad public interest and the good of the country in mind. Instead, they're voting out of their kind of narrow self-interest, and it's a sort of corrupt bargain that they're making with Democrats where they're going to get all these government benefits and freebies and handouts, and so they're voting out of their own kind of self-interest. And that argument, again, has been with us ever since, at least since the wave of immigrants from Europe in the 19th century, where there was a fear that these people didn't understand how to vote for the common good, and instead were voting only for themselves, and that this was going to corrupt the process. Why that's any different from a rich person voting for the guy who's going to cut their taxes, I don't know, but that's the argument.
Well, there's also like an embedded delusion that certainly Mitt Romney had, which was, you know, when I vote in my interests, it's not, it's for the common, like my interests are completely aligned with the common good. And proof of it is that I'm an elite. And so, and I belong here on some level, right? I mean, that to me describes the conservative ideology at its purest form, at least in the context of like the real philosophical stuff. Like, I mean, that's, if that concept didn't exist, I don't think you could have libertarianism in this country, right?
It's right.
Like, I mean, that's what I find so stunning about that, I guess, construct.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because if we want to delve quickly into this sort of philosophical aspect, it does force you to think a bit about why that's wrong and how we think about voting. And I think the way that most liberals and probably most Americans think about it is not that we're voting in the common good, for the common good, and not that that should be the goal, but rather that a vote is a way of representing our individual interest. And the more people whose individual interests are represented, and the more people who vote, the more legitimate the result. And so the winner is the person who most people think will advance their own interest. But there isn't this idea that we should, that there's some kind of larger public good that we all need to keep in mind in voting, because the good is different for all of us. But it's worth thinking that through, if nothing else.
Yeah, I mean, it is. There's a lot of tension there, right? Where it's like, is the reason to have a democracy for the sake of democracy, or is the reason to have a democracy because in certain situations it can bring about good results?
Right. And you see more and more a lot of conservatives and libertarians arguing the latter, that democracy is just a means to an end, and the end is achieving a wise government that provides good results. Whereas I think most liberals and most other people would say no, that the process itself is important, not only because that's the best way to actually achieve an effective result, but because if you don't have everybody involved in giving their consent, then the process is illegitimate.
And it's interesting because, I've always been struck by the fact that there was a conscious effort not to create a federal right to vote. Can you just outline that for people? Because I don't think there's that understanding of, when we talk about whether it's all these issues of the supposed voter fraud that takes place, which I think people who listen to this program are well-versed that it's in-person voter fraud. We do have one caller, I guess, who's convinced that there are illegals being brought over to sway comptroller votes, elections or something. But that is not a huge issue. But just give us a little sense of like the. I've lost myself. You go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, it would really transform the sort of legal landscape on these issues, and even the sort of broader kind of probably media landscape, if we did have a federal right to vote. And the fact that we don't really sort of tells you a lot about how people have thought about voting. There were arguments made at the original Constitutional Convention that voting should be explicitly defined as a right. And then they said, but wait, hold on, if we do that, then we'd have to give the right to vote to women and to blacks. And obviously that's out of the question, so we can't open that box. Later, when the 15th Amendment was being written after the Civil War to enfranchise Southern blacks, there were a lot of lawmakers who wanted to go further and not just say we're going to bar racial discrimination in voting, but say we're going to affirmatively guarantee the right to vote to everybody. Again, there was opposition because there were states and there were leaders who wanted to have the right to deny the vote to people, not necessarily even on the basis of race, but on the basis of literacy or education or a number of other factors. Even today, you have bills being introduced every year or so in Congress by Democratic members of Congress establishing a federal right to vote, and they don't go anywhere. And again, it's because when you get right down to it, there is a section of our leadership, mostly Republicans today, that don't quite believe in voting as a fundamental right, and rather think of it as a privilege. I was talking to a member of the Ohio state legislature who was in a meeting about their state's convention. They were redoing some of the convention, the Ohio Constitution, I'm sorry. And she was talking about an argument developing over new language, talking about her right to vote, where some of the Republican members said, well, hold on, we think of voting more as a privilege than a right. So that idea, you know, is still with us today.
I want to examine that because, you know, you've written a book about basically an attack, and there's other elements to this, and I want to get to those, but an assault on democracy. And there's a lot of people who are looking for the silver bullet, right? That brings us back to those times that we've had where there's been a little bit less, obviously the past couple of years we've had this broad argument that we've moved from a plutonomy to a plutocracy, right? That we're ruled by oligarchs. And some people have said the key to this, and I want to talk about campaign finance reform in a moment, but the key to this is to basically have a constitutional amendment saying in one form or another that corporations aren't people or that money's not speech or something to that effect. But I wonder if ensconcing a federal right to vote isn't the first step, has been contemplated as that silver bullet. Because once you say that we have a fundamental federal right to vote, that seems to me there's a lot of things that spin out from that. That's a legal principle that can be built upon in a myriad of ways that I wonder if sometimes get lost in this argument. Because once I have a right to vote, the government has to protect my right to vote, it begins to open up a lot of other things that the government has to do to protect that fundamental right.
Yeah, and I think you're right that it would probably end up having a significance beyond the sort of direct vote denial cases, as lawyers call them, beyond voter ID and other restrictive voting laws. It would probably have an impact on another kind of strand of this assault on democracy that I write about in the book, which is gerrymandering, where that's gone on since the founding. But when Republicans gained control of a number of big state legislatures in 2010, they used the power to redistrict in 2011. And using very sophisticated software that hadn't previously been available to redistrict in a way that gave them an enormous advantage. So you had situations where in Pennsylvania, for instance, Democrats won only 5 out of 18 congressional seats, even though they won more votes for congressional candidates than Republicans in 2012. And across the country as a whole in 2012, about 10 million more people voted for Democrats, but Republicans won 30-something more seats. And to come back to the point, I think establishing a fundamental right to vote, usually the right to vote has been interpreted as not just the physical right to vote, but to have your vote mean something. That's what's been established in some of these redistricting cases. And so once the courts kind of affirm that, it makes it much more difficult to enact a number of these different schemes to reduce the value of people's vote as well as the actual ability to vote.
And I wonder if it doesn't implicate campaign finance in some way. And I'm not quite sure how that would work out. But it seems to me that if the vote becomes a fundamental right in some ways, then things that are, infringe upon that right. And so I'm not quite clear on where it goes from there. But I have a feeling that there is a lot more legal principles. Of course, the terrain has to be favorable, right? You have to have a favorable Supreme Court, and you have to have sort of a broader acceptance of that. But
yeah,
go ahead.
Well, Well, I was going to say, I see where you're going with that, but I think once you have a favorable Supreme Court, you have a situation where the Citizens United decision and other decisions that have given rich people and corporations much more sway can be rethought, and where public financing programs, for instance, can be made easier to do in all sorts of more direct ways that can go about increasing the influence of ordinary people in elections.
Well, let me. Where do you stand on this notion of? I mean, for instance, you know, you write about Buckley v. Valeo, which is was the I guess the first of a series of cases over the course of now 40 plus years, I guess, which have increased the rights afforded to corporations and have created these ideas of money being equivalent to speech. Give me your sense of that, but also with the knowledge that, particularly in Buckley v. Valeo, I know the ACLU, I don't know if they actually filed an amicus brief, but I think they did.
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
In favor of, the idea that, that money is speech on some level. And, you know, I've been on MSNBC, many times with Tim Carney, a self-professed, libertarian whose argument is, say anything, you know, we wouldn't be able to be on that network, for instance, if you have a corporation owning MSNBC. Why do they get to have a political opinion? Why would they be able to put out a political opinion if you didn't see money as speech in some way?
Yeah. I think that the core I think the ACLU was even more involved, more than filing an amicus brief in that case. I think their lawyer was one of the lead lawyers in arguing Buckley. And I think that has to do with how the issue was seen at the time and a sort of failure to understand the impact that restricting when you can put in campaign finance regulations would have on the political landscape. And they've obviously shifted their stance on that since then. But I think the key issue that Buckley kind of laid out and that has followed from that is that it very narrow? It said any attempt to regulate campaign finance has to be in order to stop corruption. Very, very direct quid pro quo corruption, essentially. And that meant that the more obvious justification for campaign finance rules, which people had kind of subscribed to for almost a century, and which sort of is common sense when you think about it, which is just to create a basically level playing field to ensure political equality among Americans. Just as we think that everybody should have the right to vote, we think that everybody should basically be able to have the same influence in an election. But it meant that that justification was no longer allowed. And then what you saw over the next few decades, there were some decisions that kind of seemed to step back a little bit from that, and I think there was some hope that that might be rethought. But the Roberts Court in recent years has kind of doubled down on that idea. And so you had John Roberts writing in an opinion in 2011 on a public financing case, sort of reconfirming any attempt to regulate campaign finance must be very narrowly tailored to stop quid pro quo corruption. And when that idea holds, it really puts campaign finance reformers in a difficult box. It ties their hands behind their backs in terms of coming up with regulations that can meet that standard and also be effective in limiting the influence of rich people and corporations. So I think that's kind of the key.
I want to get to two other points that you talk about in terms of the attack on democracy, and one of them is preemption. I think as far as the timing went, that was pretty there was a certain amount of foresight there in including that concept, because we certainly saw that in the context of North Carolina. Tell us about the idea of preemption, and talk about Denton. I think I interviewed those folks a year or two ago. about their attempts to end fracking in like their downtown. It's unbelievable. But go ahead, talk about it.
Right. Well, this is about a group of people in Denton, Texas, which is a city about 40 miles north of Dallas, who came together and decided that they didn't want any more fracking in Denton because the fracking industry had drilled about 200 wells within the city limits. And they were concerned about the public health impact and the environmental impact. And so they organized and they got a ballot initiative on the ballot to ban fracking. It was a real kind of grassroots effort. And then they went door to door and mounted a whole grassroots campaign to convince their neighbors to vote for this ban. And in 2014, in November, they succeeded. And overwhelmingly, the fracking ban passed in Denton. So for about one night, it was a great kind of grassroots victory. The very next morning, the oil and gas industry filed a lawsuit to try to overturn it. But then what they did was more interesting. They lobbied the Texas legislature over the next few months to pass a law that would bar local governments and cities from a whole range of oil and gas regulation, including fracking, and that would apply in retrospect. So Texas passed a law like that. Obviously, the oil and gas industry has quite a lot of sway in the Texas legislature, and that law passed, and it essentially got rid of Denton's fracking ban. And so this was a very direct assault on the ability and a kind of autonomy of local governments to set the directions of their own community. The lead activist on this, he said, you know, at first I was worried about fracking, he said to me. Now I'm worried about democracy. And it's really true because it's gone way beyond Denton and fracking. In Milwaukee, voters passed another ballot initiative in 2008 to guarantee paid sick days for employees, mostly kind of fast food employees, low-wage workers, so that they could take the day off when they're sick. When Scott Walker and the Republicans came in to the Wisconsin government in 2010, they immediately passed a preemption law barring cities from passing mandatory paid sick days and from raising the minimum wage. About 17 other states have passed laws barring raises in the minimum wage. Birmingham, Alabama passed a minimum wage raise earlier this year. Almost all white, I think all white, this was going to help low-wage, mostly black fast food workers in Birmingham to raise it from the federal minimum of $7.25 up to $10.10 an hour. The all-white Republican caucus in the Alabama legislature came in and passed a law barring cities from raising the minimum wage. So it's a new kind of assault, really, on the last place where democracy still functions relatively well, which is the local level, where often you can get an organized group of citizens to come together and make something happen and create change like they did in Denton, because lobbyists can't monitor all these places around the country. They're not as strong at the local level as they are at the state and federal level. And this is an attempt, not only by Republican politicians, but by corporate lobbyists who are often working very closely with them, and the group ALEC, for instance, the American Legislative Exchange Council, that's kind of spearheaded a lot of this stuff, to go after the last place where democracy is still functioning pretty well.
I think people don't realize that law that was passed in North Carolina that was ostensibly passed to prevent Charlotte from essentially providing rights to housing and other rights to LGBTQ folks, also prohibited localities from raising their minimum wage.
That's right. It was a kind of broad attack on the ability of local governments to pass a whole range of regulations on the economy, on equality issues, on a whole bunch of stuff. It was the bathroom issue that kind of made the national news. But yeah, it was a broader attack on local democracy. And there's a reason why this is happening now, by the way, we should say, because increasingly cities like Charlotte and like big cities in Texas, like Dallas and Houston, and Austin, are emerging as kind of centers of progressive legislation, especially in Republican-controlled states, where cities are raising the minimum wage, passing equality protections for gays and lesbians, passing environmental rules. And so this is an attempt by Republican-controlled states to kind of not only attack local democracy, as we said, but stamp out one area where the progressive agenda is kind of on the rise.
Let's just talk about one last area where you, which you discuss in the book, and you refer to it as judicial engagement. This past week, we had a prime example of it when a three-judge panel from the D.C. Circuit Court found that the independence afforded the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, they have a slightly different relationship to the executive. The chair serves for 5-year terms, and their actual, it's not just at the leisure of the president. There's sort of a bar in which whether or not that person can be fired. And this three-panel court found that that was unconstitutional. It's going to be appealed and whatnot. But that's a perfect example of what you write about, right? This judicial engagement.
Yeah, that's right. I was very surprised by that decision, which was by a sort of arch-conservative Federalist Society judge, Judge Kavanaugh. And yes, it sounds like it's going to be appealed to the full D.C. Circuit, which is much more liberal. But yes, the idea that I write about in the book is that, you know, for decades, conservatives talked about the dangers of activist judges and judicial overreach and judges who were using their own judgment and overturning the will of the people as expressed through legislation or through the executive branch. Now the shoe is on the other foot, and increasingly you have this movement in conservative and libertarian legal circles to say, no, in fact, judges should not give much deference to laws or to acts of government just because they have been enacted through a democratic process. Essentially, judges should not respect the will of voters and the democratic process as much as they do, and they should be perfectly willing to use their own judgment about whether something violates the Constitution, and if they think it does, to have no qualms about striking it down, and to use a very narrow reading of the Constitution in terms of the kind of economic activity that the Constitution allows, essentially an interpretation of the Constitution that would bar minimum wage laws, that would bar all sorts of protections on workers and child workers, and to say, in fact, we may not like it, but the Constitution does bar that stuff, and the fact that this law has been passed through a democratic process really doesn't matter that much because we're talking about the Constitution. And so really to take us back to a period in the 19th century, in the early 20th century, when the Supreme Court regularly did strike down those kind of minimum wage laws.
This is going back to the Lochner era, right?
That's right. That was what Lochnerism was. And then you had a sea change where the Supreme Court began to say, actually, we think the Constitution does allow for this kind of basic economic regulation to ensure some level of equality and safety and security and so on. Now there's an attempt to reverse that. But I want to emphasize not just the sort of real world impact that would have, though that's important too, but the sort of legal philosophy that's behind it, that as I said, is to say judges are giving too much deference to the democratic process. The democratic process isn't worthy of that kind of respect because people often don't know who they're voting for, and then lawmakers don't necessarily know much about the bills that they're voting for. So judges should be able to use their kind of elite judgment to overrule the will of the people as expressed through the legislature. And that's why it ties in very closely to these other assaults on democracy in terms of voting and money in politics that I'm talking about in the book.
And we should note that it's not just sort of a growing legal philosophy, you know, amongst like the sort of the Federalist Society and et al., but Section 5, the Supreme Court ruling on Section 5 of the Voting Rights
That's
Act
right.
is a perfect example of that, right? Where they literally said, I think it was Scalia who literally wrote, like, the reason why the Senate reauthorized this is because they were too afraid to vote against
right.
it. It's just sort of insane.
Right, they didn't want to be called racists.
Yeah.
Maybe the weakest argument in a ruling I've ever heard. But yeah, the idea that Congress had just reauthorized the Voting Rights Act, including Section 5, 7 years previously, but we as justices can use our judgment to say that violates the Constitution, even though it's not even clear what part of the Constitution that this states' right to equal protection of the laws, which seems to be something that John Roberts sort of pulled out of thin air.
And it didn't violate the Constitution 15 years earlier, let's say. I mean, like, right? they wouldn't have made that argument 20. They certainly would have made that argument 40 years ago. So really, they're just making an assessment of fact, whether or not there's racism anymore in these states.
That's right, which obviously is not sort of what they're being called upon to do. And the Citizens United ruling from 2010, you can say the same thing about it. It was they were striking down aspects of the McCain-Feingold law, which had been passed by Congress eight years previously, and saying, no, in fact, we're interpreting the Constitution in such a way as to find this unconstitutional. And again, going so directly against the sort of prevailing philosophy about what judges and courts should do that you heard from conservatives for decades when they were talking about the problem of activist judges.
All right. So lastly, Zach, what do the rest of us do about this?
Well, it's interesting. There's actually it's not what should we do. It's what's happening already. And I don't want to sound all doom and gloom here, because there's actually now, as I write about in the last chapter of the book, a real two-sided battle going on where you have these attempts, for instance, to restrict voting, but on the other side you have attempts to expand voting and to expand democracy in various ways. So you have a number of states, including California, in the last year or two, have passed, for instance, automatic voter registration, where you're automatically registered to vote whenever you come into the contact with the DMV, unless you affirmatively choose not to. States are expanding early voting. They're letting people register online. So in fact, you see, over the last year or two, you see far more expansive bills on the voting stuff than you see restrictive ones, most of them in blue states. But also spreading into some kind of purple in some red states. And I think that's because, you know, broadly, democracy is popular. And so this is a way not only to make it easier to vote, but it's popular. And then on the money and politics stuff, you see increasingly kind of innovative public financing schemes. That Seattle passed one that gives every voter a $25 voucher to spend on their campaign of choice. Maine just passed a ballot initiative that expands their public financing. And that's a way of doing kind of not restrictions on political money, which the Supreme Court, of course, has made it very difficult to do, but just giving ordinary people more of a say by giving them by using public money to give ordinary people more of a voice, that I think is likely to not run afoul of even this Supreme Court, and that's very encouraging. So you really do see kind of one side fighting to expand democracy and the other fighting to contract it, and I don't think it's clear yet which direction we're going to go, but I think the fact that people like democracy portends good things on that.
Zach Roth, the book is The Great Suppression, Voting Rights, Corporate Cash, and the Conservative Assault on Democracy. Thanks so much for your time today. We'll put a link to the book at majority.fm.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, folks. Bloop, bloop. We're going to head into the fun half of the program. Just a reminder, it is your membership that keeps this program alive. It is your support that keeps this show going. We've now added a Facebook cam. Still, you know, working it out, the details of it out. But we post the free part of the show, and then we say to you when for the next half, you want to see it live. You got to. What the heck is that? Stuff is floating. They put stuff on that Facebook.
They know that you're talking about them, so they're all liking it and commenting right now.
Oh, all right.
Like some live feedback for you.
Well, how come I only have one then? Why don't
we don't
pick
have,
it up, people?
Not very many people are watching on Facebook yet.
Oh, all right. Well, forget that. It just gives you a different angle on the show, literally a different angle. And but we're going to when we go to the fun half, you got to head over to Facebook to check it out. But nevertheless, membership goes towards all sorts of improvements around here. It basically gives me the ability to. When I go to get credentialed in Vegas to get a table and power outlet and, well, Ethernet. I mean, It's like something like $400 to get 5 megabytes down. Now, I could have done a whole outside. We would have had to have like bought all the like accoutrements, right? But we could have like I could set up if we wanted to do like $15,000. I could set up like a booth out on the parking lot and just compete with CNN. I mean, I would just be there.
I think that would be a good use of the money, is to compete with CNN's display in.
Yeah, they just have like a huge booth.
I'll get working on the holographs.
Matt's going to be working on holographs. Folks, we need your support just to maintain our holograph department. Without the holograph department, where would we be? So you can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Hey, we're getting towards that season. You want to bring something to Thanksgiving? Everybody's going to want coffee afterwards, right? People are bringing all sorts of crap that is redundant. Oh, I showed up with a bag of coffee. That's very nice of you. That's thoughtful. That's actually a thoughtful gift. Yes, and it has the Majority Report logo because I bought the Majority FM blend. You don't have to tell them that you got 10% off by using the coupon code MAJORITY. You don't have to tell them that. But you give them the bag of coffee. It's delicious coffee. And then you start talking about the show. And that leads into the huge argument you're going to have about Donald Trump at Thanksgiving. And how Paul Ryan just is despicable.
It's interesting that the election will be, or Thanksgiving will be after the election. So I wonder what those conversations will be like.
You know what? So I went to a break fast yesterday. We'll talk more about this. But Indy Mike was there yesterday. And I got to say, like, Donald Trump is bringing people together. It's just that, like, the best part, though, is I said to him, for people who don't know, Indy Mike is my friend who lawyer Matthew introduced me to, who thinks he's an independent. And he gets his news from both sides. Ann Coulter on one side, Britt Hume on the other. And so I said to him, like, what do you think? How do you think it is that, like, Donald Trump became the nominee of the Republican Party? Like, do you think that could have happened in the Democratic Party? Well, no. And then it was just some convoluted reason that basically it was liberals' fault. Just can't possibly.
Personal responsibility.
Well, he said, don't you think Hillary Clinton is just as polarizing? I said, well, I mean, statistically, she's a little bit less polarizing. But but I don't think that's really what we're talking about here. Like, you find Trump despicable for reasons that I think are a little bit unique from Hillary Clinton. I don't think, you know, like I could show him those leaks and he'd be like, oh, actually, maybe she's better than I thought, except for that single payer thing. All right. Anyways, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. I don't know how I get off on that. And if you buy crap from Amazon or jet.com, do it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Go there, click on the link of either one of those, and always use that link to buy your Amazon stuff or to buy your jet.com stuff. And we get a little kickback. Gonna take a quick break. Be right back after this.